going to growing up is optional. Okay, testing. There we go. Better in the back. All right. So good to see you all this morning. Good to see so many in the groups cooperating in this day. We're going to go home this afternoon back to our own in the group, where we have a small little unit today of a couple hours time, and we'll have maybe 40, 50 people, not 100 or so. You may get here today from all your in groups. So this is a wonderful thing to see in groups work together on Unity Day. I don't know if you read today's meetings for today and Voices of Recovery, but one of them was on Unity. Jeez, how perfect. The other one was on my favorite topic, action, program of action. I didn't gain anything in this program by osmosis. It was all about action, right? No, osmosis doesn't do it. So I have to come, right? You just don't get well by going to meetings. You have to take the actions. It's a 12-step program. So, since I have so much time, I haven't had this much time. I used to have about 20 minutes and a subject. So I'm a little unsure where I'm going to go today, but I guess I'm supposed to kind of tell my story. But I can't help but getting on some subjects, like talking about working in steps and so forth, and talking about the change process, talking about the spiritual awakening. I came as an atheist, by the way, and talking about the principles. Principles, I guess, is what I'll finish up with. Let me talk a little bit about what I was like. I came to the program in 41. So, and literally, for me, recovery had to do with growing up. It's really what I said. So it was only half a joke that I was making before. I come from Appalachia, coal mining country. Only child, mentally ill, smothering mother, tells you a lot. That's what I grew up with. And an emotionless workaholic father. So my father was mostly absent, and my mother was the child of an alcoholic, abused in all ways, ran away from home to escape her father when she was 13 years old, never went back to school. So she suffered from that. She's 96 years old today, an Alzheimer, and is still suffering from all kinds of things now. But the Alzheimer, of course, covers up a lot of things. There's no question what I got from my mother. Fear, feeling of being somehow different from others, feelings of less than, not good enough, separate, different, never quite fit in, feeling like I'm on the outside looking in. That was the story of my mother. And it's not surprising, coming from where she came from and the abuse. The third time that she had her father arrested, now this is back in coal country, so you know, arrested in jail means one sheriff and one little room, that's the jail. The third time her father, the alcoholic father, got out the next morning and came to her later in the day with a straight razor and put it at her throat and said, never again, that's the last time. You do it again and you are dead. So it wasn't long after that that she ran away to the big city. The big city in Appalachia, from West Virginia, where I am, is not what you would call a big city. A big city was, at that time, probably, I don't know, maybe 5,000 people. But there were some factories there, and she got a lie about her age, and at 13 or 14, something like that, she went to work in the factory. A few years later, when she was 16 or so, she met my father, and I'm the result. So she never went back to school. She was full of anger. She was full of distrust, full of fear. I guess probably the most fearful person that I've still ever met in my entire life. And you're going to hear more from her. But my old sponsor, first sponsor, used to tell me, he was from AA and he had a way with words. He said, you know, Don, shit runs downhill. Meaning, it's intergenerational. We get it. We get this stuff. We get these propensities. You know, all we know is what we grow up with. And if there's no intervention along the way, I'll pass it on to my kids. and my kids will pass it on, et cetera, et cetera. So very clearly there is a genetic influence and an environmental influence in this. So I got a lot of stuff from her. And that the stuff I just talked about, that's the main stuff. There's somehow different, less than, not good enough, separate, never quite fit in, always worried about what others would think. I'll mention that again. For my dad, the fearless, self-sufficient guy, men don't do feelings, he would tell me. You know, just work, work, work. But on the positive side, I guess I got from him the work ethic. He did implant, by example, the idea in me that nothing comes from nothing. And that has served me well and still serves me well in OA. Nothing comes from nothing. So perseverance is probably one of my, definitely is one of my two long suits. There is no free lunch. And some of you have heard my story or read my story in the OA book know that the title is Freedom Isn't Free. And so that's the whole point of that. He had me working from about the seventh grade on. So I was doing physical work from seventh grade on. In high school, I did academically okay, but way, way below my potential. I was bored, and I focused on a lot of other things. This is the 50s, late 50s, end of the 50s. So I focused on other things that were really important at that time, like rock and roll, fast cars, sex, and sports. I mean, what else could be more important than that? And still the fear in high school, still feeling different, still feeling like the outsider looking in. The Jekyll and Hyde thing started in grade school, but it was really there in high school. Came to full bloom in high school. Lots of play acting, lots of dishonesty, because I was so afraid. I was always on stage and always pretending to be. My life was basically based upon what I thought others would think of me or what impression. So today I know that's false pride. Fear and false pride. Because false pride is one of the so-called stepchildren of fear. Right? Fear has a lot of stepchildren, controlling, perfectionism, false pride, procrastination, worry, anxiety. So much of the problems that I've had stem from that ultimate fear, doubt, and insecurity deep inside of myself. College for me was about drinking and a broken heart, the first time at college. So I went off to college with the love of my life, that first love. The dream, we went together throughout high school. The dream was that we would go to college, do the college thing, get married, you know, live happily ever after someplace, go get a great job, et cetera, et cetera. Didn't quite work out that way. In my freshman year, in our freshman year, she found something that she had been missing with me, and that was older men. She told me to grow up and get lost, and truly broke my heart. There's lots of other parts to the story, but I won't go into them today. But truly broke my heart, and hence the drinking started, really bad drinking, and not going to class. And you know, after a while, when you don't go to class, eventually they call you in and say, you know, you have 3 F's so far this semester. And that's really not what we would like you to be doing. And they asked me, thought that it might be a good idea for me to think about other things. So naturally I did the only possible thing that I could think of doing, and that was to quit and join the military. So I ran away from me, and I ran away from her, and I ran away from the culture that I was in, that I was so hated, by going into the military. That was a good thing for me, actually. I gained a lot in the military. This was 59 to 62 in the early days of Vietnam. Virtually all the people that I went through my first 6 months of training with ended up in Vietnam. I did not. Do not know why. I know what they said. It had to do with testing and so forth, but I ended up, believe it or not, in medical research, as a medical research technician in a hospital in Fort Knox, Kentucky. Well, all of my associates, my basic training people went off to Vietnam, FPO San Francisco, they called it in that day. They didn't use the word Vietnam in 59, 60, 61, 62. We weren't actually supposed to be there. Some of you are old enough to remember all that. I eventually began college again in the military, went back to school, finished up two more years of college in the military with them paying the bill. And then after college, I finished up my degree. But by this time, of course, I had a wife and a child. And so I had to work for the last couple of years. I worked three jobs while I was going to school. Did a lot of things. I've done a lot of different kinds of work. Probably the very worst work I ever did was as a cleanup guy in the pickle factory. You talk about smell. I only worked there for a month before I found something else. I went from the pickle factory to radio announcer. So, and then into the news business. So I became a roving reporter. This was down in Western Kentucky, which was a good job for me. It gave me opportunity to go to school and to study what I needed to study and yet be out there. And they gave me a car and I ran around finding news and covering news events. So I did a lot of political stuff as well as other stuff. One of the most interesting things was the interviews I did at the Burlesque House one night, and they broadcast it, so it was funny. So I remember those days. But it helped me get through school, so I've done a lot of things. So my disease progression. I was not a grossly obese child. I was in the husky size. I was always a little bit larger than others. But when I got into high school, I was into sports. And so my size worked out very well in football and in basketball and in track. So I lettered in all those things. So it was a big jock. And I did eat a lot. But of course, when you're a jock, you burn it up. I was just constantly moving. So I burned the calories. So if you look at my high school graduation period picture, I look perfectly normal. Now, I was at that time, as I look back, I of course had no idea then, but as I look back, I was still drinking pretty good and I was still eating pretty good, but I was burning it off. So my disease progression, there's no question that there is some genetic predisposition in me. My family is there. My mother's father, I've already mentioned, that looked very low bottom skid row alcoholic. There are other alcoholics in that family. So there is some genetic predisposition there. Food was always very, very important in our house. In the early days, it wasn't enough. But eventually there was enough, but of course it was Southern cooking. So my mother never met a vegetable that didn't have brown sugar in it. Literally, that's what we ate. We ate corn and cornbread, and the only vegetables we usually had was green beans, but they were cooked at length with brown sugar. And other vegetables that we ever had were cooked with brown sugar, and lots of potatoes. And that was it. It was meat and potatoes. And cornbread and lots of beans with sugar. And of course, there was always some kind of dessert with sugar. I guess I really began to get this super sensitivity to sugar early on, but I had an aunt that I stayed with from time to time. And she taught me to eat coffee bread. What is coffee bread, you say? Well, it's white bread on a plate with coffee poured over it. And then you take a teaspoon or two of sugar and put on the bread. Now, I used to eat, when I went to her house, six or seven slices of bread, which means six or seven or eight or nine teaspoons of sugar on those that bread. I loved it. It was sweet, sweet, sweet. It was better than candy. And, you know, again, as I look back, probably that's where this propensity towards sugar came in, right there. Later on, of course, it almost consumed me. I had a very fearful childhood, as I've mentioned before. Food affected my early life, but it did not destroy it. That came much, much, much later. The food really started around 1920. I was in the military, and just at the end of the military, got married. And if you want to put a date on when the food issue began, it probably goes back to about the time I got married. I had met my wife, and 6 months later I married her. And it was really a problem from the very beginning. Shouldn't have happened. It was two children marrying children. So the food started then, probably around 20. And then over a 20-year period, 20s and my 20s and 30s, the food got worse and worse and worse. I was a miserably unhappy adult. Even though on the outside I was functioning, on the outside I had finished the military, back to school, finished college, and then I went on to graduate school, and I did very, very well there. There were many companies that were courting me from across the country, big name country companies, and I eventually went to work, and I did well in the corporate setting. For many years, up to a point, and I began to acquire material things, naturally. And so, I'll come back to this, but when I came to the program at age 41, if you did not see me, and if you had read my history, you would say, okay, he came from here, he came from nothing, he worked his way through school, he did all this, he went to work for this. At that time, the most profitable corporation in the world. And he's done all these things, and look at his tremendous progression that he's had in the company. And look where he lives, and look where his kids go to school. Look at the cars that he drives. All that would be great, and you would say, wow, who's the American dream, right? This is what it's all about. But all I wanted to do at that point was kill myself. I was miserable, I had started fighting the food. But the food was clearly a symptom. I didn't know it at the time, but looking back, the food was clearly a symptom of an unhappy life. So I started eating in my 20s, and then I began the familiar stair step. You know, gain 50, lose 40, gain back, say up 70 or 80, etc. Eventually ending up around 400 pounds in my late 30s. I had lost a couple of times more than 100 pounds, and I was on my way back up. I wasn't actually at my highest when I came into the program. My highest was somewhere around 400, a little over 400. When I came into the program, I might have been, I don't know, maybe 375 or something like that. So I used the 400 just as a convenient number. So I was miserable and suicidal. But again, I'll come back to that. So that's the disease progression. Beginnings of OA, January 26, 1941, 1982. Miserably unhappy, felt trapped, concluded there was no way out. No hope. So I decided somewhere in my mid-30s that maybe I'd be better off dead. And then I obsessed on that for several years. And then finally, there were a couple of incidents where I came close, but finally on Christmas night, 1981, 3 a.m. in the morning, I got out of bed quietly. My wife was not even aware that I had left. I had prepared the note, had written the note, I had pretty much straightened up what I thought were my affairs. I had concluded, after obsessing and studying suicide for a long time, that the most humane way to do it for my wife and my two children would be not by gunshot or not by knife or not by pills, because then they would find the body. I had concluded that the best way to do it would be the Hudson River. And therefore, I would jump off the bridge and the sharks would take care of the rest, right? So there would be nobody. I would leave behind all the stuff that proved that it was a suicide. And then everybody would know, and there wouldn't be anybody body for those kids to see, or et cetera. So on Christmas night, 1981, I stole out of the house and drove my car to a bridge. This was the middle of the night, and this was not in New York. It was upstate a little bit. It was actually the Mid-Hudson Bridge in Poughkeepsie. Drove to the side of the bridge, parked the car, and left all my stuff, wallet, etc., and walked to the middle of the bridge. No one around, middle of the night, holiday. Walked to the middle of the bridge and climbed up on the railing, and then there was another little railing, and I can remember climbing up on that railing. And standing there, holding on, and looking down. Now, it was cold, it was very dark, very windy, it was snowing a little bit, and all I could see was the faint light of a tugboat coming down the Hudson, some distance, just barely make it out. And there I stood, an inch away from finishing myself off and taking care of all the misery and getting out of the entrapment. Now, the interesting part of the story is I don't remember coming down. I did not jump. I do not remember climbing down, but I physically had to climb down from that second ledge that I was on, walk back across the bridge, and go back to my car. I remember when I opened the car door and the light came on in the car. And I remember seeing my wallet and stuff laying on the seat. I remember that. I do not remember coming down and coming off the bridge. 30 days later, I walked into my first OA meeting, having absolutely no idea what the heck this was. I was actually in a rehab. I was in bad shape. My employer knew it. And my wife actually suggested, previous wife, actually suggested that she heard about this place in North Carolina. And she says, I hear they call it a fat farm, but I hear they actually treat the mind also. And boy, do you need that, she said. So remember, escape was what I was after. So the next day, I started investigating and looked good, didn't know anything about it. The most important part was they took insurance. So I went to see my employer, my boss, and talked about it. And he said, oh, we would, you know, let's go check it out with the insurance people. But if they'll let you do it, you need to do it. So I would approve a medical leave for you to go away and get yourself together. And of course, lose all that weight. Because at this point, I was, you know, 3.5, 375, something like that. And it was dramatically affecting everything that I did. So they approved it, and the following month, I went there. I remember it was a Sunday morning, and I left the house. It was about a 12-hour drive, and I made it a point of stopping at all the McDonald's on the way. I figured, well, this will be the end. Literally, I don't know how many. It must have been 6 or 8 McDonald's that they stopped at on the way down there. But I made it. I got there Sunday night. I talked briefly to somebody, and then the next morning they called me in and did all the administrative work. And then the doctor says to me, all right, tonight go to room 101. This was in the downtown of Motor Inn in Durham, North Carolina. Go to room 101. There's a meeting there you need to go to. Okay. So at 7:30 that night, I showed up in room 101, the downtown the Motor Inn. There was 10 women and me. I had no clue what was going on. So I just sat down and shut up. And they all started talking. Now, these were all patients also, right? So I sat down and they started talking. I listened to this whole meeting. And now, in retrospect, it was an OA meeting. And they were following a certain format. But at the end of the meeting, I was very confused, and I didn't know quite what was going on. I hadn't said a word. So So at the end of the meeting, the meeting is over, they close it with the serenity prayer, which was no news to me. And so I went up to the oldest woman in the room. Now I was 41, so she was probably maybe 60, maybe in her 50s. She was old for me. You know, at a certain point, everything starts to become relative, right? Obviously, right? So she was old to me, so I thought, well, I'll go to the oldest woman in the room. And I said, look, I don't know quite what's going on here tonight, but you guys kept talking about abstinence, abstinence, abstinence. I said, what in the world does sex have to do with losing weight? Absolutely true story. And the thing that she said back to me is absolutely true. It's the first time I'd ever heard it, and I've heard it many times since then. She laughed hysterically and said, keep coming back. That was my introduction to OA. I was in bad shape there. I have, what, 10:30? Yeah, I think so, 10:30, right? Mm-hmm. Till 10:30 to go to, all right. I was in bad shape there. I think I've talked about that. What I learned there early on was what it takes to get well. And I took notes there, and I'm still looking at this, still using it. They talked about what it takes to get well. One is abstinence. It's impossible to get well from an addiction without abstaining totally. The only way to get over overeating is to stop overeating. Duh. But it's true. We don't think our way into abstinence. We act our way into abstinence. I've never seen, God doesn't do food plans. God doesn't do shopping. At least I've never seen him in the supermarket or it or whatever. By the way, I didn't mention it, but when I came to the program, and I went to the program as an atheist, hardcore, bitter, angry atheist. Part of my heritage coming out of the Bible Belt, where I was convinced by age 5 or 6 that I was doomed and going to hell. Literally, that's what I was convinced of. So I rejected that. Abstinence, so that's what it takes to get well. 7 to 8 things. Abstinence, 1, hope, the gathering of hope and the expectation of better things to come. This comes from seeing that others before me have done it. Today I call that the second step, right? Came to believe that something could help me. That's the second step, hope. 3, the gathering of courage to try another way. I have to drop my false pride, take off my mask of self-will and toughness, and the I can do it myself attitude. So courage to take the action that somebody else made up rather than me. In other words, somebody else's way, not my way. Remember the self-sufficiency I talked about? This is one of the major things I had to overcome. I had to let go of the self-sufficiency and say, all right, I think you people are totally crazy, but my way doesn't seem to work, so all right, I'll open my hands and tell me what to do. In other words, psychologically, I admitted myself to the OA hospital and said, help, I don't know what to do, tell me what to do. That was a major, major big deal when I opened myself to something else. Getting honest with myself about everything in me and around me. That's the steps, of course, particularly 4 to 7. 5, restructuring my priorities. Very important for me in the beginning of the program. I was in the rehab for a couple of months and then I went home and went to start regular meetings and so forth. But restructuring my priorities. First things first. First things first then, and guess what? It's now 34 years later. And still first things first, and that's abstinence. It has to be first for me because I'm an addict. I am an addict. If I pick up the first bite, the physiological response of craving starts in me. The compulsion starts in me, and I cannot control it. So, if not taking the first bite is not the most important thing in my life today, I'm going to get in trouble very, very fast. Because that first bite, it might not be one bite today, tomorrow's going to be 2, or maybe 10, or whatever, you know, it's going to destroy my life again, because I will get out of control. And I do not wish to go back into that hell where I was. So I keep it as the most important thing in my life. It's more important than my wife, more important than my grandkids, not saying them something. It's more important than anything. Holding on, holding on, holding on. 6 was learning to discriminate. Avoiding places, things, or people who are not good for me. It was very important. I had to change my whole social milieu. when I started working the program. There were some friends that just did not need to be friends anymore. They were not good for me. Just not good for me. I remember I was driving in a carpool with some people, and these guys were just not what I needed to be. Not only did they eat all the time, bring all this food for breakfast in the morning into the car, play these hoagies and heroes and all this stuff. They were Italian, and they brought all this latest Italian stuff. We were supposed to eat that for breakfast on the road. But they were also very negative, so I had to let go of those. I had to stop going to places that might stimulate the thinking. So I changed the places I went, I changed the people that I associated with at that time. Today I always tell newcomers or people who are just starting to work, you know, for today, who knows if you'd be able to do that next year or 10 years from now, but for today, avoid those persons, places, and things that are trouble for you. Number seven was accepting that I fixed my problems by changing myself. Oh, what a terrible thing. Responsibility. Remember I said growing up? Growing up is realizing that I am responsible for myself. Growing up is having to let go of blaming everybody. So I had to begin to let go of blaming my mother, the environment that I grew up in, all those bad programs that I got, I'll mention some of those in a minute. I had to let go of all that stuff and be accountable. Accountable, right? That's about step nine. Being accountable for who I am, standing up and taking responsibility. And the last thing was, of course, taking actions, working the steps, using the tools. Those are the actions. So it's kind of basic 101. Abstinence, hope, courage, getting honest, priorities, discriminate, actions, and accountability. It's just another way of saying what the steps are all about. All right, let me talk a little bit about the change process, because that's what it was for me. I came as an atheist, bitter, hardcore atheist, suicidal, and grossly obese. Other than that, I had everything going for me. So, if there had not been they put a big book in my hand. Back at this rehab, the first thing I did was hand me a big book and say, all the answers are in here. And they handed me also the AA 1212. Remember, this is 81, there was no OA 1212. There was no OA literature to speak of other than the so-called, some people call it the brown book, some people call it the chocolate book, the stories. Now there's the third edition of that now. But that's all the literature there was, and there was a few pamphlets. So everything was based upon the AA literature in those days. And so they handed me the big book and said, the answers are here. And so I, being who I was, this self-sufficient, arrogant SOB, I read the big book cover to cover very quickly. And I remember going back to Charlie, my first sponsor, who was the epitome of tough love. Matter of fact, he was a hard ass. I remember going back to him and saying, you know, not a bad book. I get it. I think I'll be able to do this just fine. But this book is really outdated. And it's sexist. And I think it needs to be rewritten. And you know, I have a lot of experience in writing, and I think maybe I'm just the guy to do it. And that was the first time I heard the shut up, take the cotton out of your ears, you know, put it in your mouth, just listen. You know, did you come here to argue? Did you come here to think? Just follow the instructions, trust the process, etc., etc. So he put me down pretty good. And so I had to prove that I was right, of course, so I learned to binge there in that rehab I was in. I didn't know what binging was about. I was a grazer. I just ate all the time. And then I heard these people talking about binging, so I said, well, I don't know. Let me try that. So I went out and binged, and oh, you got so sick. So I learned to binge in OA, right? I've often said OA totally screwed up my eating. You know, I can't binge in peace anymore. I can't graze in peace. I can't do any of those things. So The interesting part of that book, of course, for me as a hardcore atheist and rejecting all the God stuff, was Appendix 2, that said, hey, by the way, the definition of spiritual awakening is also personality change. Personality change. Now, that I could deal with. Personality change I could deal with, because it had nothing to do with God. At that time, it seemed to me it didn't have anything to do with God. And so I said, okay. So the program for me, the recovery for me, was very much a personality change. It was working very hard on trying to reprogram myself, if you like, to get rid of those old habits that were self-destructive and replace them with positive habits that are constructive. And so a great deal of that was, a great deal of my recovery was about that. So my personality rebuilding in the program was about acting my way into right thinking, not thinking my way into right acting. Today, that's about 6 and 7. That's the way I talk about 6 and 7. So, you know, I learned to walk by walking. I learned to swim by swimming. I learned to stop overeating by stopping overeating. I learned to work the program by working the program. Think about that. You learn to work the program by working the program. You learn to work the steps by working the steps. You learn to stop overeating by stopping overeating. I learned to be more giving by giving more. I learned to be more accepting by acting more accepting. I learned to be a different person by being a different person. So I act my way into right thinking, I think my way into right acting. So, some examples of the dysfunctional thinking that had to be dealt with. Fear was a biggie. Fear of what might happen, fear of change, fear of not good enough, fear of less than, back to the mother thing that I talked about before, right? Fear of looking stupid, fear of failure, fear of being old, sick, poor, and alone. The old, sick, poor, and alone began to come in later, right? It wasn't so much in the 40s, but then someplace in the mid-50s or 60s. I won't even talk about the 70s. Another one was this, what the Big Book calls self-centeredness. It's the, or controlling, right? This is this mental master planning in my head of imposing shoulds and oughts on the world. The way things ought to be. This ought to be that way, you ought to be that way. Always in my head spinning scenarios and movies of the way things ought to go. Here today, everywhere else, right? And that, of course, only sets me up for frustration. Because the problem is, if I'm directing the world in my head, you don't know. You can't read my mind, so you don't know what you're supposed to do. And then when you don't do it, I get pissed. And you say, why are you angry? Right? It's all in my head, all in my head, all in my head. So that's the mental master planning. That's the controlling of the Big Book. That is was a big problem. Perfectionism driven by fear, setting standards for myself impossible to meet. Right? Perfectionism is driven by those fears that I talked about. Not good enough, inadequate, gonna look silly, gonna look stupid, etc., gonna fail, gonna get fired. And so that's how I became a compulsive worker, which I didn't mention. One of the reasons I did well in the corporate world was I was a compulsive worker. If you work 16 hours a day, you know, you're going to do well. Self-pity, victim, blaming, it's all their fault. Wrong everything, poor me, poor me, pour me a drink, as you say in AA. The end result of the if onlys. You know, if only this, if only that, if only I came from a different place, if only I had a different education, if only I had a different wife, if only I had a different kid who didn't do this terrible stuff that she does. If only I had a different boss, different company, etc., etc. If only OA were different, etc., etc. Right? Well, you know, nonsense. I am responsible, as I said early on. I am responsible for my recovery. I am responsible, actually, for my feelings, which is a hard one to accept. But the fact of the matter is, I can change how I feel by changing the sentences going through my head. I can change how I feel by changing the sentences going through my head. You all are listening to me, and certain sentences that I'm saying are going through your head. You may be feeling differently than you did 30 minutes ago. I use this every single morning of my life. It's called the morning quiet time, where I read and I write and I do prayers and I do affirmations, a lot of affirmations that are helpful to bring me out of the negative thinking that I often wake up with. Anger and resentment, I've mentioned. Some of the bad beliefs that I had that came from my childhood, My worth is dependent on what you think of me. That came from my mother. What will they think? What will they think? When I was this old, I remember her saying, what will they think? What will they think? So my whole life was based upon doing what I thought you would like to get me strokes or accolades or not criticize me or whatever. So my worth is not dependent upon what you think of me. My worth is dependent upon what I think of me. Self-sufficiency is a virtue I mentioned before. It's not. I need everyone's approval to feel okay. Not true. Sometimes I call these my bullshit paradigms. Because this is the way I thought. And you know, in a different audience after all these, instead of saying not true, I would say bullshit. But I won't do that this morning. Suffering is a virtue. This came from the fundamentalist Calvinist background that I came from. Some way or another, you're closer to God when things are painful. And having fun, some of you may recognize some of this, depending on where you grew up. And having fun is somehow sort of sinful. And that's what I grew up with. I'm a prisoner of my past. I am shaped and trapped in who I am, what I experienced and where I came from. That controls my life. Not true. No matter where I'm going, I start from where I am. You know, I can always start from where I am and build a whole new me. Where I came from, I can break away from that. I am not a prisoner. And this is another one from my parents. The best way to never be disappointed is to expect the worst from people. Absolutely true. My pain is caused by other people or events, so I have little ability to control my feelings. Not true. I am in charge of my feelings. Achievement equals self-esteem. That's another way you become a compulsive worker. Because some way or another, every achievement makes you feel good. And that's what that was like, that hamster. On and on and on, and I would get the raise, or I would get the accolades, or I would get the bonus, whatever, and I would feel really, really good for about 5 minutes. And then I would be back. So, ever on. Achievement does not equal self-esteem and self-worth. If I truly surrender to God, God will take care of everything. I'll say that one again. If I truly surrender everything to God, God will take care of everything. Not true. This is a program, physical, emotional, and spiritual. I got a lot of work to do. I call it a partnership, actually. Partnership with God. God's not going to do for me what I need to do for myself. As I said before, cynically, you know, God doesn't do food plans, and God doesn't do the shopping or the preparation. God doesn't take me to the meetings. God doesn't do all those things. God doesn't actually change me. If you read and you look carefully at 6 and 7, where we ask God to take these shortcomings away, if you go on, if you look carefully at that, you'll see what he really does is give me the strength to practice the new things. He gives me the strength to act in those ways. And I want to talk a little bit about that, I think, right now. At the time that I have left. How I got well and stay well. Let me just go through the steps briefly. I put down the food in step one. I had to detox from food so I could objectively examine my life, since food was the symptom, not the problem. I accepted I had an incurable but arrestable disease over which willpower was useless, and I could never treat food like a normal eater. I can never ever treat food like a normal eater. I have a disease. It's just is. I had a huge amount of trouble accepting the addiction model in the beginning. Huge amount of trouble. I intellectualized everything. Charlie once said to me, Don, you know, your problem is you came to this program educated beyond your intelligence. And at first, I thought it was a compliment. Charlie was full of those. But eventually, after ruling out every other possibility under the sun, I said, you know, I'm just going to act as if it's an addiction. And if it's an addiction, then it's very clear that I have to abstain from the substance that I'm addicted to. So I was addicted to, in my case, sugar, refined carbohydrates, all the junk stuff. I said, all right, I'm just going to abstain from that. I don't know if it's true, but I'm just going to abstain from it. Well, I'm now on 32 years of abstinence, maintaining about 185-pound weight loss now for 30 years. And I'm still acting as if I'm an addict. Because it works. You know? So who knows? But that certainly seems to be the way my brain works. Step two, from seeing and hearing recovery in the OA rooms, I gained the hope that kept me coming back. An atheist, none of the God stuff. I went through the steps clearly as an atheist, sort of. I probably, along the way, eased into that agnostic thing. And there are people today that would say that I'm neither of those things, but I don't know. That's the great thing about this program. You know, it's whatever works for you. I might actually close with my spiritual principles here, and you might think that no, he's not really an agnostic or an atheist anymore, but it's been a very, very long journey. Step three, committed to work in the program and the rest of the steps. You know, so step three for me had nothing to do with higher power. Step three was not giving up, it was deciding to cooperate. That's what surrender is for me. That's my definition of surrender. It's not giving up, it's deciding to cooperate. And so what I did in the third step was commit myself to doing this, the rest of this stuff, back to the OA hospital, right? All right, I'll do all of this stuff. I don't get it. And again, back to the Charlie, he says, you don't have to get it. Trust the process. It's worked for thousands and thousands and thousands of people before you. So in steps 4, 5, 6, and 7, the change steps, I began rebuilding myself into the person I think God intended me to be. Oh, there's that word that crept back in, God. I began to face and kneel rather than whine and eat. Whining and whining and eating was my deal. I began to face life and deal with life. So a lot of changes. I began taking responsibility, no more blaming others. I began to let go of the self-centeredness and the controlling. I stopped the mental master planning that I talked about in the head scenarios. That thinking set me up to always be frustrated because people didn't do the things I thought they should. I began to let go of the self-sabotaging perfectionism that ensured that I would always feel not good enough. I began to let go of selfishness. There was a gradual paradigm shift from how do I get what I want to how can I be useful. If I were to summarize the whole personality change in one line, that would be it. The move from the self to the other side. How can I be useful? How can I give? How can I serve? So it's a very different footing than I'm on today. I began practicing acceptance and letting go of anger and resentment. I began to practice courage rather than fear. For a long time, it was simply white-knuckle courage. But as you've heard 1,000 times, courage is not the absence of fear. It's doing it anyway. So it was not faith that led me out of fear for a while. It was fear didn't actually leave me until sometime around, I think, the summer of 86 or something like that. So maybe 4 or 5 years in program, there was still anxiety and fear working on me and controlling me to some degree. But I remember at a certain point, I just remember it was summer, sometime in that period, I suddenly realized that fear didn't control me anymore. And that I was doing things that I used to be afraid of. And some of that was just basically that tough love sponsor that said, I don't give a crap if you're afraid, do it anyway. And of course, everybody here knows what happens if you do something you're afraid to do. Well, if you need to do it again, you're not so afraid the next time. That's just the way it works. And of course, after we've done something, we look back and say, why was I so afraid to do that? That's that poor little boy down deep inside of me. King Baby, as my sponsor used to say. I began to be authentic rather than a phony. Remember I said I spent my life on stage, I spent my life pretending because I was so afraid that if you saw the real me, etc. Always pretending, always seeking strokes. Step five was all about getting honest. That was my first, step five for me was actually the beginning of becoming who I really was. My step five was the very, very, very first time ever that I was honest with another person. So my time is up. So I didn't get to the spiritual principles. Maybe in a workshop someplace we'll see. Or maybe later. But I'm going to thank you guys for having me. I just also want to tell you how grateful I am that OA saved my life. Because OA did save my life. Totally, not exaggerating, saved my life, gave me a life. And so these last 34 years have been the most phenomenal experience of my life. I feel like God gave me a second chance. I get a second 40. First 40, I screwed it up. God gave me a second chance, so I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to stick around. Thanks.